My name's Scott Ritter. I was commissioned in 1984 as an officer in the United States Marine Corps. I spent several years as an intelligence officer at the brigade level and then later at the battalion level with a field artillery battalion. We were part of the rapid deployment force, and that meant that we needed to be prepared to deploy at a moment's notice, primarily to respond to potential threats in the Middle East. One of the threats that we were worried about was a Soviet incursion into Iran, and we trained exclusively to defeat the Soviet enemy. I spent over 2.5 years solely focused on learning how to kill Russians. Fortunately, I never had the opportunity to do that. Instead, fate got me involved in weapons inspections in the former Soviet Union when the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty was signed in 1988 or 1987, and then implemented in 88. I was literally the first inspector on the ground in the Soviet Union and helped write the book on on-site inspections. When my time there ended in 1990, I went back to the Marine Corps and was immediately caught up in the Iran-Iraq war, the Iraq invasion of Kuwait. And I spent the war assigned to General Schwarzkopf's staff as an intelligence officer, and I was given the task of working with special operations forces in the Air Force to interdict Iraqi Scud missiles before they could be fired off against Israel and in Saudi Arabia. And I think when the war ended, I left the Marine Corps, thought I was going to go into civilian business, but fate had something else. The United Nations had been tasked with disarming Iraq, and my experience as an intelligence officer with arms control experience and knowledge of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction made me an ideal candidate to be recruited to set up an intelligence capability, which later grew into a role as an inspector. And I spent 7 years doing that job from 1991 to 1998, including numerous missions as chief inspector. I resigned in 1998 because of differences with the United States government over what the ultimate objective was in Iraq. I believe the objective was disarmament. The United States government believed the objective was regime change. And since that time, I've been speaking out and writing in a manner that's critical of U.S. foreign policy.
Just touching on the first Gulf War there, Scott, which you were involved in, obviously, history, hindsight is now advising us that actually April Glasby, who is the U.S. ambassador over there, tricked Saddam Hussein into thinking that the U.S. wouldn't have a position if they were to reclaim Kuwait, which was, after all, many people said was Iraqi sovereign territory, which had been wrested from them earlier that century. And so do you think that there was an attempt to trick the Iraqis, who had been long time U.S. allies in the Middle East, into invading Kuwait?
I don't believe so. I mean, I'm very familiar with April Glasby. I'm familiar with the transcript of her conversation with Saddam Hussein, and I'm familiar with the diplomatic cables that went back and forth. Advising, there was a lot of confusion in the State Department at that time, and the U.S. policy was that they would not take a position on Iraq's claims about the border disputes between Kuwait and in Iraq. But under no circumstances do I believe that this was a green light for Saddam to invade. And the reason why I say that is Central Command, which is the U.S. military combat command responsible for that area of the world, was taken by surprise. And I know that for a fact, absolute statement of fact, taken by surprise. So if this was a trick by April Glasby, only she knew about the trick. It wasn't communicated to the rest of the U.S. government. And everybody was taken by surprise when Saddam Hussein rolled into Kuwait. I can also say that had Saddam limited his advance to simply taking control of disputed oil fields and disputed border regions, that the United States would not have responded militarily. Only when Saddam extended his troops down to the Saudi border, thereby creating the potential of an Iraqi thrust into the eastern Saudi oil fields, did the United States deem it necessary to mobilize for military intervention. But, you know, again, I don't claim to have absolute knowledge over everything, but my understanding of the facts is that the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait took the United States by surprise, and it did not appear to be some sort of grand trick.
I mean, CENTCOM may have been taken by surprise, but possibly other parts of the, you know, U.S. command structure weren't, and maybe even other nations allied to the U.S. weren't. But anyway, this unified command structure of which CENTCOM is a part, I've noticed over the years the Russians, formerly the Soviets, the particularly the Chinese these days, are pointing to this and saying, well, how arrogant the United States has got this unified command structure which covers the world, where the US military is actually targeting the entire world with its stratagems, and this is a dangerous thing, and that actually the US should back off and maybe just have a defensive command for the United States, for North America, and forget the idea of trying to have US military influence all over the world.
I concur. I mean, I believe the United States is a global power, and has global responsibilities. But those responsibilities do not automatically translate into a need to project military power. And I think that these unified combatant commands are inherently disruptive to international peace and security. One of the main problems, besides the fact that we forward deploy military forces who engage in combat on a moment's notice, is that the military ends up taking over relationships between the United States and other nations. I can state with just absolute certainty, and I guarantee you every civilian ambassador in the region would agree with me, that the most powerful person representing the United States in Saudi Arabia during the period of time that I was involved was not Chaz Freeman, the U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia, but Norman Schwarzkopf, the commander of CENTCOM. And I would say that holds true, or held true, throughout our 2003 invasion of Iraq, our invasion and occupation of Afghanistan, our ongoing operations in Syria. It's not the civilian leadership, it's not the ambassadors, it's not the State Department that is taking the lead in representing the United States. It's the military combatant commands, and this is a huge problem. So, I agree. The best thing we could do is dissolve these combatant commands. First of all, right now the United States is having a recruiting problem. Yeah, the quickest way to recoup tens of thousands of personnel is to dissolve these combatant commands and send those people back down to their respective services so they can have real jobs that aren't disruptive to international peace and security. But, and you don't need to have these combatant commands. The United States is a mature military force. If a situation arises where we had to deploy forces overseas, our independent, the Marine Corps, the Army, and every are capable of forming ad hoc combat commands for that purpose. You don't need to have a full-time staff that's, taking the lead in representing American interests abroad, because then America becomes defined by its military power and not its diplomatic strength.
To what extent are these unified command structures staffed by former proven field officers? Because the big danger here is that if they're not, then you've got a kind of ivory tower where these guys, and they normally are guys, are making decisions which will affect tens of thousands of soldiers, possibly many millions even of civilians, without having sufficient experience and proven success in the field.
Well, it's not just success in the field, it's success in your respective branch of service. I mean, if you're a Marine, you should know about the Marine Corps. You should have time in the Marine Corps, in the Fleet Marine Force, in your chosen military occupation specialty. And then you have value added when you join a joint staff. But what's happening is that, we've created this network of what are known as purple positions, purple being, of course, joint positions. And people can spend a career in purple positions, meaning they don't know anything about their branch of service. They don't have any experience in a combat arms or combat support, MOS. They're simply staff officers, professional staff officers who spent their entire career behind a desk working a problem from a theoretical standpoint as opposed to applying practical knowledge to real world problems. So this is a huge problem. And again, I think one of the best gifts we could give to military recruiters is to dissolve these combatant commands and take the tens of thousands of personnel who are currently assigned to them and return them to their respective branches of service so they can get real world experience doing the jobs that they're supposed to do, not these congressionally mandated jobs that only dilute American power. And as you said, it we end up, having people operate from an ivory tower who have no real world experience, they've never gotten feet on the ground, boots on the ground. They don't have any dust on their boots. And that's just not a good thing.
I'm just chuckling here, thinking of the comparison with the London media, particularly the broadcast media, which is managed and operated by a whole phalanx of managers who've never been anywhere near a live microphone or a camera. And I think this is a particularly bizarre aspect of modern society, that many of the people that are actually running things have had no experience anywhere near the ground. Anyway, look, the big conflict at the moment is in Ukraine. A lot of people looking at that, and there seems to have been some changes over the last week or so, Scott, with actually critical voices in the West coming into the Washington Press, the London Press, about Zelensky himself, that he may not be up to the job.
Well, there's no doubt that he's not up to the job. He was never up to the job. He was always a comedian who was punching above his weight. There was some hope that as an outsider to, normal Ukrainian politics, that he might be able to shake the system up. But early on, he proved, inadequate to the task. And instead of, surrounding himself with qualified people, Zelensky proved that he, as an individual, was not competent for this job, because he fired the competent people and surrounded himself with cronies whom he had, learned to trust during his entertainment, business, during his time as a comedian, as a television star, et cetera. And that would be the equivalent of, a Hollywood president going to the White House, firing his competent staff and surrounding himself with television producers and, Hollywood executives and things like that. I mean, it might make the Hollywood president feel good, but you're certainly not going to have competent government. And so Zelensky was incompetent from the start. He dropped his popularity. This is even before the war. He dropped down to 23%. And in order to stay in power, this is a man who we've sold as this great democratic force. He shut down all political opposition parties. He shut down all opposition media. And he went to bed with the far right, with the, right sector, with, other right wing political parties and their military progeny, the Azov Regiment, IDAR, Kraken. Units of this nature, he's now shaking hands with them, giving them medals, bringing them into his inner circle, promoting them within the Ministry of Defense, within the, within the police, the Interior Ministry. And this is all before the war. And then the war came, and he has just been incompetent since day one. People who follow this know that there's been a constant feud between Zelensky and his inner circle and the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense over decisions made about, allocation of forces and things of that nature. Zelensky's more about creating a perception of Ukrainian victory so that he can continue to receive weapons and monies from the West, as opposed to actually preparing the Ukrainian military to conduct an adequate defense. And as a result, tens of thousands of Ukrainian soldiers have lost their lives through this incompetent utilization, employment of forces. So there's a big problem with this. And I think the media, you can only propagate a lie for so long. eventually the truth will out. And right now, I think the world is waking up to reality that Zelensky is incompetent. And I think that the other thing they're waking up to is that he may not be long for this world. There is a real risk of the Ukrainian defense ministry taking matters into their own hands and removing him from power, because he is literally destroying the military and destroying Ukraine in the process. And there's a growing number of senior military officers who are just fed up with this.
From a military point of view, what's he done wrong then?
Well, the first thing he did wrong was to actually go to war against Russia. I mean, this is a guy who, you know, got on TV, I think it was in 2019, and talked about, you know, how he would get on his knees and crawl to the Russians and beg them to bring about peace in the Donbas, to not go to war, that he would do anything to save Ukraine,
Yeah, but look, Scott, because Russians invaded the Donbas, if you don't remember, which is part of Ukraine, not the other way around.
No, let me correct you. Ukraine initiated genocide against ethnic Russians in 2014. That is a statement of fact. The Azov Regiment, Idar, Kraken, the Nazis rolled into the Donbas, took over Mariupol, brutally raped and murdered ethnic Russians. And you're going to tell me Russia invaded Ukraine? No. What Russia did is provide support to the ethnic Russians in Ukraine to save their lives. And it became a civil conflict. Russia, throughout this period of time, from 2014 to 2022, respected the territorial integrity of Ukraine. They refused to recognize the independence of the Donbas. Even when the citizens, the Russian ethnic Russians, said, we want our independence, we want to be part of Russia, Vladimir Putin and the Russian government said, no, you are part of Ukraine. What we will fight for is to have the Ukrainian government give you autonomy, respect your language, your culture. Because remember, these neo-Nazis working in Kiev banned the Russian language, banned Russian culture, banned being Russian. They call them orcs. They treat them as subhumans. This is documented fact. And the Russians said, we'll fight to protect your rights, but you are part of Ukraine. In 2015, the France and Germany formed something called the Normandy Forum. And they worked with the Ukrainians and the Russians to come up with what's called the Minsk Accords. Ukraine agreed to implement this. What was required is for Ukraine to take the Minsk Accords to the parliament and get it ratified so that these new laws would be passed. And then we'd have peace. Peace would break out. The Donbas would be Ukraine. The ethnic Russians would have their rights protected. Ukrainian government never ratified it. Why? We now know. Poroshenko, the president before Zelensky, has admitted that the Minsk Accords was a sham from the start. A sham. The sole purpose of the Minsk Accords was to buy time so that NATO could train the Ukrainian army, so that the Ukrainian army could forcefully conquer the Donbas. And NATO did that from 2015 to 2022. NATO was training a battalion every 55 days. That's 40 battalions that were trained, equipped, and organized by NATO, sent east for the sole purpose of killing Russians. And we also now know that the Ukrainians took this army, 60,000 of them, and massed them in eastern Ukraine, preparing to carry out their own offensive against the Donbas starting in March of 2022. What the Russians did is, in accordance with Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, implemented what's known as collective preemptive self-defense. You say, that's weird. That's like word spaghetti. What are you doing, Ritter? I'm using the same language that NATO used to justify their military intervention in Kosovo in 1999. Russia didn't invent this. They just perfected it. And then so Russia carried out a preemptive military attack to prevent Ukraine from moving on the Donbas. Russia didn't invade Ukraine. Russia carried out a special military operation. I'm not playing games here. An invasion is war. And if Russia went to war against Ukraine, we wouldn't be having this conversation today, because Ukraine would be wiped off the face of the earth. Russia carried out a special military operation to prevent Ukraine from launching a military assault on the Donbas. Remember, before Russia invaded or carried out the special military operation, they recognized the independence of both the Lugansk People's Republic and the Donetsk People's Republic. And they did not want to do for 8 years, but they were compelled to do it because it became apparent that Ukraine was never going to implement the Minsk Accords and that NATO was never going to be a good faith partner in this, that instead NATO was seeking to have Ukraine join NATO and take this 260,000 man army that NATO trained and use it aggressively against ethnic Russians. So no, I take great umbrage at the notion that Russia invaded Ukraine. They did no such thing.
Okay, Scott, I did interrupt you, and you were just explaining how it is that Zelensky, what military mistakes he's made that might mean that his defense ministry might actually turn on him.
Well, the biggest mistake he made was going to war with Russia. The next biggest mistake he made was not recognizing that Ukraine lacked sufficient military force and structure to prevent Russia from liberating the Donbas. What Zelensky should have done early on was accept the Russian terms, accept the loss of the Donbas, accept the loss of Crimea, preserve his nation, preserve his sovereignty, etc. That didn't happen. The other thing was that, and by doing this, you understand, he locked Ukraine into a battle they could not win because the vast majority of Ukrainian forces now became pinned down in the Donbas. You see, if had he withdrawn from the Donbas, he would have preserved 250,000 troops. Why do I say 250,000? Because that's the number of casualties Ukraine has actually suffered. We know this because there's been documents leaked by the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense. 191,000 casualties within the army and then approximately 60,000 among the border guards, the Air Force and other military units. 250,000 people, of whom around 70 to 80,000 are dead. This is solely because Zelensky made the decision to lock his military into an impossible situation in the Donbas. Ask the Ukrainian military today what's going on. They send battalions to the front lines. These battalions are prepared to fight the Russians. They arrive in the trenches. They spend the next couple of days getting blown away by Russian artillery until they lose 50, 60% of their forces and they're withdrawn, having never seen a Russian. So the Ukrainians are getting butchered without ever having the opportunity to kill a Russian. This is all because of Zelensky trying to create the perception of capability where no such capability exists. And he needs to create this perception so he can continue to get arms and financing from the West. Ukrainian military resents this. They resent the fact that they've been compelled to take some of their best trained units and use them in offensive operations just so Zelensky can say, I've launched a counterattack. We always get the headlines from the British media, the American media. The Ukrainians have counterattacked in Kherson. We never get the rest of the story. That within 12 hours of the counterattack, the entire force has been wiped out by Russian artillery and Russian air, that they've accomplished nothing other than being slaughtered. That's the truth. And the Ukrainian military is fed up with this.
So the next question has got to be, is Zelensky incompetent or is he working in the interests of some foreign power?
Both. An incompetent leader is somebody who allows foreign powers to dictate policy to him. A competent leader would tell the Americans and the British, hey, take a seat over there while I determine what the policy direction will be. And then I will come to you for the assistance I need to implement the policy I've decided on. But that's not what's happening here. The British and the Americans are telling him what they want. And they've pretty much admitted. I mean, we have the Biden administration saying right up front that they need the Ukrainians to inflict pain on the Russians, which means that the priority right now is to try and inflict casualties on the Russians as opposed to preserving Ukraine. Let's remember this following fact. Prior to the introduction of NATO heavy weapons, Russia was probably going to limit its advance to the Donbas, to parts of Kherson and parts of Zaporizhia that allowed them to create a land bridge connecting Crimea with the Donbas.
Okay, when you say heavy weapons, Scott, for the layman, what does that mean exactly?
Well, when the war started, NATO was pretty much limited, or in the United States were limited to giving Ukraine anti-tank weapons, man-portable anti-tank weapons like the Javelin missile, like the In-Law British weapon, like the Stinger anti-tank missile or anti-aircraft missile. Now they're giving them heavy artillery, self-propelled artillery, rocket artillery, tanks, helicopters, in significant numbers, by the way. And all they've done here is keep in mind, let's say that the United States and Great Britain provide 100 pieces of equipment, heavy equipment. First of all, Ukrainians have to get trained on this. So they have to take away some of their best soldiers and take them out of the country for 3 to 4 weeks to get trained on this equipment. That's okay. Now they bring this equipment in back to Ukraine. 70% of this equipment doesn't make it to the front line, which means it's probably being interdicted by the Russian military, either in the warehouses, on trains, on trucks, etc. It's not making it to the front lines. When it does make it to the front lines, the life expectancy of this equipment is very short, and they're dying violently. And every time the Russians knock off a Ukrainian howitzer, knock off a Ukrainian tank, they're killing the best Ukrainian troops, the ones who just got training. So they're depleting the cream of the crop, so to speak, of Ukrainian troops. But what's happening here is the Russians have said, hey, because you've done this, you're extending this war and you're increasing the pain we're suffering, because all of this equipment does translate into Russian casualties, not nearly on the scope and scale that the Ukrainians are suffering. But nonetheless, hundreds of Russians are dying because of this. And Russia has now said that because you've done this, we're no longer satisfied with limited territorial acquisition. We're taking, for instance, all of Ukraine. It has ethnic Russians, a chance that's known as Novaya Russia, which includes Odessa, Kherson, Dnipropetrovsk, Zaporizhia, Kharkov. This will all be Russian when it's all said and done. And the Russians are proving that they're going to do this because there's nothing the Ukrainians can do to stop them, even when they receive tens of billions of dollars of advanced weaponry from NATO, from the United States, from other powers.
Well, this brings us on to the next question, which is reports over the last few weeks of lots of the arms, which have been the weaponry, which is being supplied to Ukraine, actually simply being sold on by a kind of Ukrainian mafia to arms dealers simply to raise money. And also the same happening with the financial support for Ukraine. A lot of that going missing too, Scott. Have you heard those reports? Do you think they're true?
I've heard the reports and I am convinced they're true. I'm also convinced that, you know, the U.S. government is complicit in this. Why would I say that? Well, the $40 billion supplemental defense acquisition bill that was passed by the U.S. Congress in May of this year, one senator rose up in opposition. He wasn't opposed to giving Ukraine the aid, but what he wanted was the imposition of an inspector general who would oversee how this stuff was being utilized. Where did it get to whom it was supposed to? How were they spending the money? Was it being spent on what Congress wanted? What was happening to it? Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, and McConnell, the Minority Leader, both came together with the support of their parties in opposition. So basically, the United States said, no, we're giving this money to Ukraine, and we're not going to require Ukraine to tell us anything about how it's spent, where it's going. One of the reasons why this happens is that the United States government knows how Ukraine works. It is one of the most corrupt governments in the world, the most corrupt government in Europe today. And it only works through bribes. It only works, through this corruption. So we can't, if we tried to impose a system of accountability on the Ukrainians, they would cease to function because they don't know how to behave responsibly. Their entire system is about corruption, about bribery, about theft. And that's just how it works. And so there's no doubt in my mind that the vast majority of the money that we're sending the Ukrainians is not going to whom it's supposed to go, but rather lining the pockets of the power brokers who then decide how they're going to dole it out, how much they're going to keep for themselves, etc. The light weaponry, like the NLAWs, the javelins and the stingers, this stuff's being sold on the black market. We know this. It's out there. We see it. The United States has sent a drone called the Switchblade, which it gets shot up in the air and then it hovers over the battlefield until it can be told to pick a target, or somebody can pick a target for it, and then it'll go in and blow it up. They're selling that now for $4,000. What we're doing is depriving Ukrainians at the front lines of weapons that they would need to have an adequate defense. And B, we're empowering criminal groups and terrorist groups in Europe and around the world with weapons they otherwise wouldn't have. And one of these days, there will be, you know, blowback. A javelin will be used against a politician's armored car and the politician will die. A stinger will be used to shoot down an airliner with hundreds of innocent civilians on it. And a switchblade drone will be used to assassinate somebody. I mean, this is what's happening here. And shame on the United States, because we could have, you know, we've been selling weapons to people for a long time. We know how to do it. We know how to account for these weapons. And it's very easy to put a tracking device on these weapons so that they can be accounted for. That's how we do it. You go into a warehouse, you come in with your reader, you scan each weapon. You now know that all weapons are accounted for. When a weapon's expended in combat, a form is filled out, and that says this is how the weapon was disposed of. If a weapon malfunctions, need to be repaired. Again, scanned, shipped off, we know where that weapon is. It's not hard. We do it all the time. Don't do it in Ukraine, because Ukraine is, again, the most corrupt place in Europe, and it can't function with the kind of norms and standards that the rest of Europe and the rest of the world is accustomed to.
Well, I noticed that it was a Ukraine. I was quite surprised to see this, Scott. Al Jazeera and other people reported back on the 17th of July, a Ukrainian cargo plane carrying weapons crashed in Greece. Well, it didn't seem to be heading towards Ukraine. No, it was heading away en route from Serbia to Bangladesh.
Yeah, I mean, but what I understand is that cargo plane was actually, even though it was flagged to Ukraine, it was a contract aircraft, and that the weapons on board may not have been Ukrainian, probably Serbian. So there's something about that it's still part of the dark market for weapon sales. But I actually think on this one, the Ukrainians get a pass, not because they're innocent, just because they weren't involved in that particular scam.
Also, this week, last week, at the end of last week, Amnesty International pointed out that you've got, they sent a special team in, a bit like your weapons inspectors, to look at the positions of deployment of the Ukrainian army, noticing that hospitals and schools seem to be their favourite positions to have as their military bases. Now, some commentators have said, well, this is normal in battle. Amnesty have called the Ukrainians out, which I found quite surprising, really. Amnesty tends to, in military situations, actually lean a little bit pro-NATO, but this time they've stuck their neck out and they're saying that the Ukrainian army is actually deliberately endangering civilians here. Now, is it fair in military terms? Because these are the sorts of positions which the Russians will be much more reluctant to attack, Scott, aren't they?
Well, first of all, we know the Russians are reluctant to attack because the Russian Ministry of Defense on a daily basis releases a list of these targets, saying that in this town, the school has been occupied by this unit, boom, boom, boom. And then the Russians do not attack that location. The Russians are calling the Ukrainians out on this, and they aren't attacking it, especially when they know that the Ukrainians, because it's not just, here's the deal. If let's say I'm defending city of Albany, I'm allowed to defend the city of Albany. What I'm not allowed to do is hold the population of Albany hostage. I can't use them as human shield. So what any normal law-abiding nation would do is evacuate the civilian population of Albany and turn it into a fortress city. And in doing so, schools, hospitals, and all other formerly protected sites no longer have that protection because they're going to be turned into military defense locations. That's normal. When people say that's what happens in wartime, it's normal. They're right. As long as a building is not being used for its purposes, like a school isn't being used for a school or a hospital is not being used for a hospital, and instead you put military equipment there, it's a military target. It's fair game. What's happening here, though, is that the Ukrainians are, you know, they're occupying buildings and they're keeping the civilians there as human shields. And this is what Amnesty is calling them out for. This is what the Washington Post called them out for earlier. And one of the reasons why they're doing this is that there's overwhelming evidence coming from the Ukrainian people themselves. You have mothers going up to the Ukraine saying, get your tank out of here. You're near my home. My children live here. If you have your tank here, the Russians are going to attack you and you're going to endanger my family. This is happening over and over and over again. We talked about the casualties earlier, approximately 250,000 Ukrainian casualties. I would say that the Russians have probably suffered somewhere in the region of 50,000 casualties, dead and wounded. That's 300,000 joint casualties. Normally in large scale ground combat like this, it takes place in urban environment or heavily populated environment. You get a 1-to-1 casualty ratio between the civilians and the military. And here we have a situation where the Ukrainians are documented as using their own population as human shields. But here's the amazing fact. About 8,000 to 10,000 Ukrainian civilians have died. That's a lot. That's sad. But you know what? The civilian to military casualty ratio is historically low. Historically low. And when you have dead civilians, it's primarily because the Ukrainian army has used the civilians as human shields. The fact that this casualty level is so low is proof positive of the kind of campaign that the Russians are running. This is not the indiscriminate use of firepower that the West is talking about. This is the most disciplined application of combat power in modern history. Because, again, how can I say that? Look at the ratio dead civilians, dead combatants. It is historically low. Historically low. You know, if the United States was running this campaign, based upon what we did to Mosul, what we did to Raqqa, what we've done to Fallujah, you could expect hundreds of thousands of dead civilians, because that's how we roll. The Russians are rolling differently. They're being very disciplined in their fire. That's one of the reasons why their rates of advance are so slow, because they're being assiduous. They know when the Ukrainians are dug in to civilian areas, and they're avoiding heavy combat in that area until which time the civilians are evacuated. When in reality, they would have every right to attack that place and kill civilians. International humanitarian law is quite clear that when a combatant power digs into a civilian facility, it loses protection. It loses protection. Therefore, let's say the Ukrainians dig into a hospital that's functioning. That hospital is no longer protected. The Russians have every legal right to attack it, but they're not. They're not. And I wish Amnesty International would tell the rest of the story. It's great that they call out the Ukrainians for what they're doing. But you know what? The Russians need to get full credit for how they're pursuing this conflict.
So we've also seen the ramping up of tension with China over Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan. Now, I mean, all of this, particularly with the Russians, though, is putting people in mind, since we've seen many of the treaties that you were involved in implementing torn up, of a potential nuclear war. And although this is, not necessarily, imminent, we just don't know. We're now in a situation where those treaties which were there to stop this happening, many of them are no longer there, Scott. And we've just had Hiroshima Day, the anniversary of the exploding of the first nuclear weapon by President Truman, on Japan at the end of the Second World War. What are your thoughts about the prospects for nuclear war? Because it's very difficult to know quite how alarmist to be. We hear all sorts of scare stories about the climate and that sort of thing. And nuclear, it's almost as if it's just another one. So what's the reality?
Well, the reality is we live in a very dangerous world where sides that are, let's be honest, NATO is engaged in a proxy war against Russia. I mean, that's unheard of. Unheard of, but it's happening. NATO is a nuclear armed alliance, and the Russians have nuclear weapons. So, you can't be dismissive of the potential for a miscalculation by either party that could lead to nuclear conflict. I mean, we had a situation where Lithuania decided to unilaterally impose a blockade on Kaliningrad. Lithuania is a NATO member. And Russia was on the verge of taking Lithuania off the map. Fortunately, the European Union stepped in and negotiated a compromise that preserved Lithuania and, frankly speaking, the rest of the Baltics, because Russia wouldn't have stopped at Lithuania. Had Russia gone into Lithuania with every right, because a blockade is an act of war, Lithuania could have or would have cited Article 5 and demanded people come to their defense. And if that had happened, you'd have a general war between Russia and NATO. And more than likely, Russia would prevail conventionally, perhaps drive on Warsaw, and NATO might be tempted to use a nuclear weapon to stop the Russian advance.
Okay, to interrupt you, but what was the deal struck over Kaliningrad?
That the Russians were allowed to continue providing shipping goods via rail to Kaliningrad. The Lithuanians stopped the rail traffic, violating treaty obligations, and in effect imposing a land blockade of Kaliningrad. So basically, the Europeans said, "No, let them keep supplying, let them keep shipping via rail." So that was the compromise.
Okay, it's amazing, because this is almost like an equivalent of the Soviet Union stopping the Brits and the Americans communicating with West Berlin and the Berlin airlift. I interrupted you over the nuclear threat. What's the reality?
Well, I'm saying there's a number of scenarios in Europe. I talked about Lithuania. There's the Poland moving into Western Ukraine scenario. There's Moldova moving against Transnistria. There's a number of things outside of the Ukrainian conflict itself that could lead to a NATO-Russian conflict that could manifest itself in a nuclear conflict. I think, however, all parties are aware of the dangers and are guarding against that kind of inadvertent trigger. I don't believe Europe is going to fall down the rabbit hole of pursuing direct conflict between NATO and Russia that could turn nuclear. My big fear is in the Pacific, because here China is dead serious about Taiwan. I mean, they just literally blockaded Taiwan for a week using military exercises that were a de facto training for an invasion of Taiwan. They flexed their muscles very strong, and they said, that they will continue these exercises and that they're prepared to take military action if Taiwan seeks to be independent or if other nations treat Taiwan as independent. One of the things that happened during these exercises is that China said that the Taiwan Strait that separates mainland China from Taiwan, because China has a policy of one China, that it's not international waters, that it's purely the territorial waters of China, and nobody has a right to transit through that. So the United States and its eternal genius is going to challenge China by sailing American warships through the Taiwan Strait. Now, China is not going to sink the ship, I don't believe. I do think that China is going to say, once the ships go through, that's enough. You guys don't respect our territorial integrity. We're taking Taiwan off the map. Now what? President Biden has committed that the United States will defend Taiwan in case of a Chinese attack. How is he going to defend? With what? The only thing we have is a fleet. And the closer the fleet gets to Taiwan, the more certainty is that that fleet will be sunk. These ships are extraordinarily vulnerable to Chinese missiles with hypersonic warheads. We don't have any defense against them. But what happens when China sinks 5 ships, killing 15,000 Americans in one instant swoop? The United States will be compelled to seek retaliation for face-saving means only. That means that we will probably launch a low-yield nuclear weapon against a Chinese military facility, probably on the island of Hainan. There's a naval base there that we think we can take out without significant civilian collateral damage. So we'll nuke China under the belief that by escalating, we then force China to de-escalate. What do you think China's going to do? Accept one of their cities, one of their naval facilities being nuked? No, they'll retaliate by nuking an American place, maybe the island of Guam. Will we accept that? Then we're going to nuke Shanghai. Then they're going to nuke Los Angeles. And then it's all she wrote. This is the biggest danger. Nuclear war in the Pacific, because the United States is engaged in irresponsible policies that we can't back up. I mean, I gave a speech in June in Houston, Texas, and the thematic of the speech was sort of stolen from Top Gun. But it was that Joe Biden's writing checks with his mouth that the American body can't cash. Committing to the defense of Taiwan when we neither have a military plan to do so, nor the forces allocated to do so, nor the means to actually implement it, is the height of hubris and ignorance. It's a very dangerous situation.
Now, the big news of this week, Scott, is the raid on Donald Trump's house. I wonder what you make of that. It's apparently happened just a day before the deadline for the midterm elections, because there is a moratorium on FBI actions in the run-up to an election on political figures. And so what do you make of this raid? It seems apparently Trump has some confidential documents that the FBI or the government would rather he didn't have. I wonder what you make of it all.
Well, first of all, I don't know enough to speak competently on this topic. I will say, and this is just a matter of public record, I don't trust the FBI, and I do believe that the FBI operates with political motive. So there is a distinct possibility, indeed probability, that the Department of Justice was weaponized for political purposes. But I can't prove that. I'm just saying that it wouldn't surprise me if that took place. You know, Donald Trump possessing these documents, I'm not an expert on the law. In fact, I don't know specifically which laws he's accused of violating, because the U.S. government hasn't produced the warrant yet that was used to facilitate the search. What I can say is that while he was president, he had unilateral authority to declassify anything he wanted. So the notion that he's holding on to classified material is absurd in extreme. If he, as the chief executive, used his authority to classify documents, they're legally not classified documents anymore. And again, this would be an example of FBI overreach. But I need now to back away from this, because we don't know all the facts.
No, we don't. And it could simply be that those documents he didn't officially declassify, but he kept copies of anyway. Who knows? And who knows? One of the other interesting things, which is I've been following from the US coverage, is that the safe, apparently that they brought a safe cracker in to open, was when they opened it was empty. So maybe Trump has just been one step ahead of them. But anyway, by far the most relevant of your books, Scott, on this whole topic is the one on nuclear weapons. Can you just give us the title and how people can get hold of it if they want?
Well, I mean, that's my second book called Scorpion King. And it's basically a history of American arms control from FDR to Trump. But I would say that my most relevant book is my most recent book, Disarmament in the Time of Perestroika, which is a history of the INF Treaty and the implementation of the INF Treaty. And the reason why I say it's important, you know, George Santayana, American philosopher, once said that those who fail to heed the lessons of history are condemned to repeat it. That's always in a negative connotation, like history is, it's a history of bad things. The INF Treaty is actually the history of a great success, a fundamental success, a success of disarmament that helped a reduced tension between the United States and the Soviet Union in the 1980s, tension that models directly what's taking place today. So I also view this book as a template of hope, meaning people say, how do we get out of this mess that we're in? And I say, we've already done it. We did it once. Here it is, the history of it. Let's repeat this history. We can apply it today, and we can navigate ourselves out of these waters. So I put that book up, Disarmament in the Time of Perestroika, as the most relevant book, because it does provide a template of how the United States can work with Russia in a constructive fashion to get itself out of this crisis that currently exists.
Well, I mean, every single human being on this planet relies on those treaties when they go to bed at night. How on earth did they get unraveled, Scott?
Well, that's solely the fault of the United States. Unfortunately, the United States, especially since the end of the Cold War, has, during the Cold War, we treated the Soviet Union with respect. We treated them as our equals. We respected the fact that they could destroy us. And so when we entered into a treaty, it was a treaty based upon mutual respect and mutual reciprocity. What happened to the Soviets happened to us, and vice versa. But with the collapse of the Soviet Union, we no longer treated the Russians with the same respect, and we started to seek unilateral advantage through these treaties. And when treaties became inconvenient to us, meaning that we deemed that they gave the Russians too much gave them too much leverage over our national security, that they didn't rate now because they were a lesser power, like the ABM treaty, anti-ballistic missile treaty, which George W. Bush withdrew from in 2002, like the intermediate nuclear forces treaty, the one that I implemented, that Donald Trump withdrew from in 2019. And like the end of START 3, which we just, you know, we just said we're not going to do this treaty because Russia no longer rates that kind of disarmament preference. We withdrew from the open skies treaty, you know, that allowed airplanes to fly over each other's territory to provide a modicum of confidence that there wasn't a military buildup or anything. We created the conditions that brought about the demise of the conventional forces in Europe treaty. You know, we every 4 to 8 years, we elect a new chief executive. And it's usually we rotate parties. It's very rare that you get back to back parties, which means there's an inherent inconsistency in American foreign policy and American national security policy. You know, since 2000, Vladimir Putin's had to deal with, you know, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, Donald Trump, and Joe Biden. Every one of those presidents had a different approach to foreign policy and national security policy. So Russia is getting seesawed, whiplashed back and forth with an inconsistency that's inherent in the way that America does business. And one of the downfalls of this is that chief executives just make a decision that they no longer want to implement treaties that were ratified decades ago. And so we've proven ourselves to be untrustworthy when it comes to this kind of treaty. And that's why, again, I say with the INF treaty, the history of it, you know, that was the groundbreaking treaty. That's the one that broke the ice on-site inspection. That's where the term trust but verify became in vogue. We need to recapture that moment. We need to re-inject trust into our arms control relationship with Russia. You know, we've done it in the past. We can do it again. And hopefully we can also educate Congress with the need that once they ratify a treaty, they need to rise to the defense of that treaty, not allow a chief executive on a whim to withdraw from it. Because all you do in the when that occurs is that you think you're getting improving American national security policy, but what you're doing is diminishing global trust in the United States as a reliable negotiating partner.
Yeah, I'm reminded of the line from the 1962 Bond film, Dr. No, penned by Ian Fleming, of course, British naval intelligence officer during the Second World War. World domination, same old dream. And of course, sometimes I'm afraid these things just do, history does repeat itself. People just decide that the old guarantees that were there for world peace just don't exist. Anyway, Scott Ritter, thanks very much for joining us once more.
Thanks for having me.